Welcome everybody to Midweek Mysticism. We're back with the Zohar. So we'll hop right into it. Now, remind me, last week, did we finish this sixth commandment, or did we get right to the end and just not
Right to
finish?
the last paragraph.
Okay, so we will
Never avoid.
finish the sixth commandments and then jump to the seventh and eighth commandments. Buckle up. Okay, so. Gets a little wild, as it always does. Okay. So we talked about how
Carry.
So we talked about last week the sixth commandment, pru or vu, procreation, and in the Zohar's reread of it, again reading the verses in Genesis, Yishritzu Hashemayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya, building on the idea of Yishritzu Hashemayim first as Yishritzu Hamayim, the water swarming. The first version of the water swarming was the study of Torah below, that generates life, sheretz nefesh chaya, the ofyo faith ala aretz al pnei rekiah shamayim, and then birds fly in the sky, and the birds were angels. And Rabbi Confer wrote a beautiful kind of poetic distillation of that teaching. Torah study below gives birth to angels above and creates an angel in that person's own soul, a holy soul. And then the Zohar wants to deepen the read. It's not just that one can create new theological realities, but emerging from that, out of that, or after that. Something's coming. Is the possibility not of creating new theoretical life, but new actual life. And so the Zohar looks to the human, or not just human, potential to procreate as the proof. The theory that people are partners in God's creation, that it's not that God created and left the world alone, but people have theurgic, that is, the possibility of being actively part of a process that draws down and creates yesh me'ayin, new things that didn't exist before. It's kind of remarkable anytime you want to think about that. So, and I think people recognize that when they or people connect, isn't it? Give birth. It's like there's a new person that exists now. So, in that reread of it, Yishritzu Hashemayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya becomes a metaphor for sexual activity, not Torah study. The Of Yofef Ala Aretz becomes the holy soul flying down from heaven to enter the world. Very earthly action, or as Peter had suggested a couple of times, sherets, actions that have maybe even a negative connotation, like sexuality, and certainly whether it should or shouldn't, it's one thing, but certainly there are plenty of religious, philosophical, and human traditions right from the beginning where Adam and Eve are embarrassed because they're naked, right? Sexuality is kind of always complicated for humans, I think. It's a fair statement. Nonetheless, has this extremely holy potential. And so this is a version, just to be clear, of a kind of mystical relative sex positivity from the Zohar, that procreation is an extremely holy action, and that one should engage in it as a form of religious. It's the sixth commandment of the Zohar's emanated peremptory commandments. Okay, now, whoever avoids engendering new life, I think that's where we are, What if you don't? I just want to acknowledge from the outset, not everyone gets that choice, you know? And people never find the right person, can't if they want to, etc. I don't, just read it in a modern context. We're going to read the text as it is. Whoever avoids engendering new life diminishes, as it were, the image comprising all images. Move the window to see the text. Causing the waters of that river to flow no more, damaging the holy covenant on all sides. Concerning him, it is written, they will go out and stare at the corpses of a people who rebelled against me. Indeed, this is for the body. As for a soul, it does not pass through the curtain at all. It is banished from that world. So let's just unpack this kind of cursed or dark ending to this commandment. You'll notice the other commandments we've read so far haven't contained a warning for people that fail to engage in the commandment. This is different. And so one of the questions you might want to think about is, why does this sixth commandment, as opposed to reciting the Shema or having Yira, get a warning that if you don't do it, there are consequences? So what are those consequences? The first interesting feature, whoever avoids it, diminishes the image comprising all images. What is the image comprising all images? What does that phrase? That is a not common phrase. Yeah. Just maybe I'll pull out the Aramaic for that. So the Aramaic is that. Umand itmenami priya revia, kivyachol azeir diukna de kalel kol diuknin. They shrink, so to speak, kivyachol diukna de kalel kol diuknin. The image, diukna de kalel kol diuknin. It includes all diuknin. So a few things I want to say. The first idea is, I think there's a pun here. They diminish ze'er. So of course, ze'er, diminished, is the very term used for God of the Sfirot, of Tiferet. In other words, the mystics, certainly the Lurianic mystics, imagine, and the Zohar itself later will imagine that there is ze'er anpin, that there is the small face God, the God we're talking about of the Sfirot, because even that is diminished from the God of ultimate mercy and unknowability of Kasher, this just will of the undifferentiated loving kindness. And so there is a play in which the person that doesn't engage in procreation diminishes the diminished face of God. God is already diminished, and the person that doesn't engage in this cuts off their connection to that diminished part of God. And so I think the Zohar is playing with itself, even mitigating its own curse in a certain way of saying there are always these kind of diminutions of divine flow that occur even within God's self. But you can be part of that too. And that's not ideal. The ideal is you want to be opening up more divine flow. So there's just a punness to it, in my opinion. Second thing I want to say is diukna, the color called diukna, is related, of course, to tselem, tselem Elohim. And so there's an idea here in which if people are the tselem Elohim, the Zohar is making a you could give like an interesting lecture, what different Jewish thinkers and what it means to be created in the image of God. What does it mean to be created in the image of God? I think people popularly like to cite the Unkelus, the Targum Unkelus, Ruach Mimam Imalala, right? A talking being. It's very commonly cited in lectures. But there are many different opinions. Maimonides has a different idea that people are capable of knowing truth and the causes of truth. Following Aristotle and basically every philosopher, whoever was a philosopher, the knowledge of a thing and its causes and the causes of its causes, as far back as the causal chain can go, is the way in which one knows truth. And in that way, we approach the Tamim Deot for Maimonides, the preferred way of describing God, the all-knowing or of perfect knowledge or the cause of knowledge, even. But here we have a different idea of what it means to be created in the image of God, which is to be able to procreate, to create. God is fundamentally the creator. And to the extent that we can be creative, then we are in the image of God, the creator. And there's no creation like creating new life, which is precisely what God created, life. And so that is, I think, the Zohar is hiding in this negative description, its theory about what the interpretation of what it means to be B'Tselem Elohim in the image of God, by saying in the negative, whoever doesn't do this diminishes that image of God, which comprises all images. Now, they're doing another thing, as the Zohar does whenever you start to think about what it's saying. you start to really appreciate whoever wrote this, that lyrically, you know, it's controversial to say people are created in the image of a God, right? The Zohar loves harping on controversial themes and then deepening how controversial they are, doubling down. Another favorite Zohar move, to double down on proposed heresy. So God has no form, right? Lo ra'itim kol tmuna, you did not see any image. And yet here, the image, or any picture, but the image of God is a very, one of the most powerful Jewish ideas. Some people would say it's the, you know, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg would say it's the most important Jewish idea, that every human being is created in the Jewish, in the image of God. It's the Jewish version of Kant, that every person is of unique and infinite value, and therefore a prerequisite for all ethics. So here, you'll note that God's, how can God have an image, is a version of saying, how can an unknowable, indefinite, unlimited, infinite, all-powerful God be limited in any way or defined, even by the Sfirot or certainly by people? And the answer is, God is the image comprising all images. All possible physical representations are contained within God. God is the cause of all images. Of course, God has no image, but is the cause of all images. And so all images are contained within God. And if all possible images are contained within God, then God can only fully be manifest when all possible images come to fruition. And so everyone needs to have as many children as possible, such that the infinite possibility of versions of life can come into reality. Just like every Chidush Torah needs to be made manifest. And so everyone must engage in the Chidush Torah. Of course, no one should ever say anything that their rabbi didn't say before and was not authorized, so they might die a fiery death. But every new teaching must exist. And every new life has to exist. If it doesn't, hey, we've diminished God. So the people are created in the image of God isn't so much a diminution of God, it's actually a praise of God, that God can be the singular source of such diverse life. Wow. So just in using this term, the image comprising all images, which so far as I can tell is original to the Zohar, it's just saying a whole lot about its understanding of Tzelem Elohim, just by using that kind of phrase. In my opinion, all these things are evident from the use of that phrase. Okay. So whoever avoids that, now that you understand the importance to the Zohar of this, and they diminish the image comprising all images because those images haven't come into existence yet. They're only in potential, causing the waters of that river to flow no more, damaging the Holy Covenant on all sides. So what do we mean damaging Kayama Kedisha, the Holy Covenant, Bochol Sitrin, on every side? On every side. Like, what is on every side, Ed? So I think What they're talking about here is the description of Yesod, right? Yesod is this place where upper energy is gathered before it descends into the world of Shekhinah. And sorry. Do I have you? Can you hear me? Okay. So I think what it means is all of the different pathways of which energy flowed into Yesod are now damaged, so to speak. Because the point of all this is not for things to remain in potential, but to come into existence. The point of creation is to create. God didn't make God's self, but for us, but for things to exist. And so all of the upper world, so to speak, every front of upper world energy, all the channels of heaven, are kind of like hit a traffic jam. Maybe that's the metaphor here. If you don't, there's all this. It's not just that you don't have children. It's not a personal problem. It's a cosmic problem now. All this energy, which was waiting to come through a particular person, can't manifest. Concerning him, it is written, they will go out and stare at the corpses of the people who rebelled against me. Indeed. So, what's the issue here? If you procreate, then you are in the image of God. But if you don't, so if you learn Torah, you may remember a person has a holy soul, but if not, they don't have a holy soul, just a regular soul. And here, if you create, so you are in the image of God by bringing forth the image of God. But if you don't create, true, someone created you, but you're not creative. And so you are not really in the image of God. So if you're not really in the image of God, you are not holy. And if you are not holy, you are just a zombie, says the Zohar. So they're rereading this verse from Isaiah, not as talking about corpses like dead people who rebelled. Look at all these dead people who rebelled against me, but rather living corpses. The living dead. That's for the body. As for his soul, it does not pass through the curtain at all. As it is banished from the world. So the traditional way to understand this is when we say it does not pass through the curtain, we mean here something like the curtain into the next world. That soul gets stuck in this world, which forms the theological prerequisite for an idea of reincarnation. If you don't wind up having children, no worries. We've just upped the stakes here. But lots of people didn't have children, can't have children. And by the way, for the Zohar, the stakes are so high that it's not just technical fulfillment. It's like anyone could have, should have more children in this version of it. So if not, you won't escape the world. It's banished from the next world, which is a way of saying you get stuck in this world, according to most of the commentators.
And what's the word for curtain? Is it the Achareha Pargod, or is it a different curtain word?
Yes, it
Is
is
that?
lo ayol lepargoda klal. You will not ascend past the curtain at all. Pargod. Well done.
Well, that's the usual, I heard it behind the curtain that this is that.
Me'acharei hapargod, yeah.
Is going to happen, meaning from some heavenly realm, secret heavenly realm. Interesting. Okay.
So here you get the idea also, which comes about a little bit, that people without children can't enter the secrets of the Zohar or whatever. Obviously not true. Now, I have to say, one could liberalize the teaching if they want and make it not about procreating children, but just creativity altogether, right? That would be like a modern, less judgmental, less exacting read of it. One could understand this as an ode to human creativity and bringing new things forth into the world and read it just fine that way. But of course, they're working with the Jewish rabbinic tradition where having children is assigned this kind of religious, but like they're religious and they're fundamentally conservative, even as they're totally creative. Of course, anytime the Zohar is giving an ode to creativity, one must know that they were extremely creative in their interpretation of things. And so they're going to go all in on creativity. That's not a shock. But
can I ask, what do we, if it's up to, and maybe you're getting there, but what are the implications of adding the sort of punishment angle to it? I'd say in the context of like, I'm doing another shiur about the Gemara, the Makot, which is like all about sort of the idea of you each, basically it's very technical halakha where you're kind of like, you need to have a warning, you need to have like a defined punishment. And then there's all about the Hazara and the kind of, not to like get into all that, but it's significant. There's a big deal made when you have just a commandment that's given as a commandment and then a commandment that's given and then says like, but if you, there's a punishment to it where it's like mot yamot afterward or something like that, that kind of creates like a different paradigm halakhically. Is there anything implied here that anybody has ever written about that's somehow this has a halakhic implication to it? Sorry if that question didn't make sense.
No, I mean, it's a question I asked, I think, which is why does the Zohar choose, it's a version of that question, why does the Zohar choose this one to kind of lay down the law and say, anyone who doesn't do this? So you could give the plain answer, which is to say, it's not about some, this is not halacha, it's mysticism. So the Zohar is concerned that someone might not want to engage in this. And why might someone, this is my answer, if no one has an answer. Why might someone not want to engage in this? They're not speaking to the selfish person that doesn't want to deal with kids. I don't think they're even speaking to the woman suffering from infertility or the couple suffering from infertility or whatever the situation is. The Zohar is responding to a strain in Maimonidean thought in all of these. But so I think it's always right to look at, you know, by having 14 as opposed to 13, well, what's the Maimonidean sense of it as a comparison? So what is the Maimonidean sense of procreation? And it's a mitzvah, it's counted in the 613. But to the extent that Maimonides talks about sex, one should do as little of it as possible because it's base and non-intellectual and animalistic and not the exalted way in which it's something that is like unfortunately necessary as part of being a human animal, but certainly not something particularly wonderful and not our most elevated feature, which is the mind. And Maimonides thinks people should avoid drinking and food and music and parties, and so all of those things are for common people who are gluttons. Maimonides is very negative when he talks about sexuality. And as who was the professor at JTS that wrote the biography of Maimonides? Talking about
Albertal?
No, I'm talking about there was that biography of Maimonides years ago. Wildly controversial because he claims and tries to defend the idea Maimonides ordered a hit on an important Egyptian official and had him drowned in the Nile.
I don't know that.
He also claims Maimonides became Muzin. There are all kinds of fairly radical claims. Joel Roth, was that his name?
No, he's a Talmudist. He would have been one of the historians, probably. But I don't know.
Hold on. Maimonides. Well, let me look really quickly. Okay, well, there's a recent biography of Maimonides, which was pretty, that made some incredible claims. Anyway, so in that book, One of the things they highlighted was the Spanish milieu Maimonides would have existed in which people were regularly having these kind of garden parties with poetry and music and provocative women and food and wine. And so the culture in Spain, the elite culture in Spain at the time, at least according to some chapters in the book, Maimonides was very much reacting to the culture in which he existed, which was a materially wealthy and fairly affluent culture, and at least during his time in Spain. And all that is to say, the Zohar goes anti-Maimonides here, right? They say not only is procreation and engaging in it, right, a mitzvah, it's crucial. Not only is it crucial, it's the very definition of what it means to be in the image of God. This is not some embarrassing feature of humanity. It's the defining feature of humanity. So that's, you know, like from the end to end kind of debate, if you want to read it like that, which is why I think they're saying whoever, you know, because notice what the Aramaic is, uman di'itmena, one who limits or prevents this. So there's a sense in which one could even fulfill the mitzvah, but they're saying one who, you know, doesn't engage in this because they don't want to. And you get the sense from Maimonides' writings that, you know, it was to be apologized for. So, and in many Jewish thinkers, not just Maimonides, you know, in the medieval period.
Also, Maimonides doesn't see it having cosmic ripples. So that's a you know, certainly a big difference. But, you know, yes. He's probably right. He's pushing back against Maimonides, who sees it only as a minimum necessity to procreate and not to enjoy it too much. And this puts it in a much more cosmic realm.
Yeah, and one would think that this formed, you know, the basis for some of the most radical Kabbalistic Hasidic thinkers who, you know, had Yehudim, unifications and prayers and things to recite before sexual intercourse. The only time I've ever seen that is I have a Hasidic Sidur from the Toldos Aaron sect of Hasidim in Jerusalem. I like to collect Sidurim, a little hobby of mine, and not historical Sidurim, you know, just different Sidurim and usage and of all sorts, including Hasidic Sidurim. And I have one from the Toldos Aaron sect of Hasidim that is also used by a portion of Satmar Hasidim, is the Hungarian Hasidic Sidur. And in there, there's a, you know, prayer to be recited before sex. And it kind of references some of these Zoharic ideas. So it forms the basis for that. And more radically, you know, some of the Sabbatean and Frankist ideas surrounding sex that got cut out of the Jewish canon when they were part of wild, false messianic movements. Mm-hmm. But you see how the underpinnings for, you know, kind of more promiscuous Jewish understandings of procreation emerge out of this Kabbalistic, you know, once it's cosmically significant or divinely empowering to be having children, suddenly sexual activity can be viewed in an almost like, you could view it very differently than Maimonides, even much more than the Zohar is willing to go, you know, some of the thinkers that dealt with it were.
So it's fundamentally, it's like anti-ascetic, basically.
Yeah. Now here, it doesn't actually, what the Zohar does not do is attribute that to the sexual activity itself. It just attributes it to the procreation. So the Zohar is measured in how it describes it. Unlike, say, Shabtai Tzvi, or Jacob Frank, or you know, some of the figures that then had their followers engage in orgiastic kinds of activities and things in the name of mysticism. The Zohar is not all the way over there. It's in the middle. But which brings us to the next commandment. Remember, they flow in order. So of course the next commandment is circumcision, which can fundamentally be viewed as, it wants to be a kind of set, a check on sexual energy, right? And this is part of the Zohar conservatism, you know, always walking us to the edge and then taking it a step back. That's so view of this in that way. That's the Zohar loves to do that. Say new chidushim, nothing too new. The seventh commandment. Does anyone else have anything they want to say about the sixth commandment? The seventh commandment, to circumcise on the eighth day, removing the filth of the foreskin. For the living being is the eighth of all rungs, and the soul that is blown from her should appear before her on the eighth day, since she is the eighth rung. Then it is clearly seen that she, the nefesh chaya, a soul of that holy living being, not from the other side, the sitra achra. This is yisritzu hamayim, let the waters swarm. In the book of Enoch, let the water of the holy seed be inscribed with the mark of nefesh chaya, a soul of a living being. This is the mark of the letter Yud, inscribed in the holy flesh in preference to all other marks of the world. What's going on here? So let us unpack. There's always like Zohar 101 and Zohar 201. And sometimes it helps to do Zohar 201 first. Zohar 201 is always to ask, what image or thing are they actually imagining that then finds expression in particular verses or words? There's always a thing they're getting at, a concept, and usually an image. Usually it's a metaphor from the natural world, as Professor Heldad Eschner points out. The natural world formed the bulk of the Zohar's metaphors, and psukim, mainly from Shir HaShirim, the rest of them. So if you look, right, they're describing Yishritzu hamayim, let the waters swarm, and then birds will fly above. Something happens below that causes something to happen above. So here, what's the something that happens below? The something that happens below, or the swarming of water and the fish in the water, is the circumcision. And then what will happen above is a soul coming down and some involvement from Elijah flying above like a bird. But so we've done this a few times. Torah study below, holy soul above. Sex below, soul from above. Circumcision below, Elijah above. So how, let's just take the metaphor seriously. How is circumcision, which is, I think, the least obvious, you know, fish swimming in water, you can kind of see how that's a metaphor for sex. You can also see how yishritzu, that term, which can mean murmur, was an understanding of kind of the mumbling or chanting of a trance-like Torah study that they were engaged in. But how exactly does circumcision, that is cutting the foreskin and peeling it back, represent fish swimming in water? So what I came up with, that was the question I asked myself last Thursday when I began to prepare for this week. I wrote it down and I did a little brainstorming. So I came up with two possibilities, but I can't find any of them anywhere. This is reading the Zohar seriously, but not necessarily literally. You know, it's reading, it's taking the metaphor seriously, assuming we should take the metaphor seriously, which I'm committed to. So that's the power of metaphors. It could be the blood is the water and the penis is the fish swimming through the blood of the circumcision. That makes this a very powerful metaphor, or a very graphic metaphor in any event. Or it could be that the peeling back, which the Zohar will focus on, the second part of the circumcision, which is halachically required, not just the cutting, but the kind of priyah, or peeling back of the foreskin, represents in their minds the idea of a fish swimming through water and kind of displacing the liquid that it's immersed in. The text will make a play between the words Yishritsu and Yitresh Shemun in the Aramaic to inscribe from Rishimu. So it could be that it's not a visual metaphor, but it's an audio metaphor. And that the word Yishritsu sounds like Yitrishmun, especially if you imagine that they pronounce the tough in Yitrishmun with somewhere softer than our T. I don't know what Hebrew was in 13th century Spain. It's possible to imagine it wasn't an Ashkenazic Saf, but it was something like the Yemenite Thaf or something like that, right? In which case it was Yithrishmun, which sounds a lot more like Yishritsu, and Sh sound more like each other than Ta and Sha. It's a little harder to equate. Does that make sense? And so what is being inscribed? Well, precisely what's being inscribed here. Right, we said the letter Yud is being inscribed. The letter, they imagine that the mile is like a scribe. And by doing this is creating the letter Yud out of the penis, inscribing the mark through the act of removing that which is evil. In which case, there's not an actual visual comparison to fish swarming. It's Yishritsu and Yithrishu.
Can we just come back to the inscribing? Yeah. But in the benching, we say, "Britcha shecha tamta bivsarenu." So inscribing the brit in the circumcision may have a kind of, I don't know, Hebrew regular analog of chatam.
Right. I mean, so much so that the Talmud then questions. And in certain liturgical traditions, women didn't recite that part when they recited the Birkat HaMazon because we don't do female circumcision. So, right, interesting. So this idea of inscription is a kind of mystical analog to the rabbinic norm of talking about Mila in that way. And so here they want to know, well, what exactly is being inscribed? They're taking that to the next level.
And then they're taking that to another level.
What did you say before, Mike?
I got everyone there. Okay. So now, what exactly is happening? The living being is the eighth of all rungs, and the soul is flown from her. Okay, so Shechina, we have Yishritsu Hashemayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya, moving up from the soul to the Nefesh Chaya, to this upper level soul. So how do we get the soul to descend from something high to something low? And the answer is, oddly, feminine. Oddly feminine, because we're talking about Bris Mila, talking about male circumcision. But we're really talking about the meeting of masculine and feminine energies here as a kind of way of talking about procreation and creation altogether. There's never masculine or feminine. There's always masculine and feminine in balance, even when talking about circumcision, even when talking about the penis itself. So the Bina and Malchut or Shechina are eight apart. According to the vast majority of commentators, that's the eight we're talking about here. And so we get an answer to the question, why mystically is the circumcision on the eighth day? Because the soul, which is birthed from Bina, the divine cosmic mother above in Kol Chai, descends to her daughter, Shechina, the Kala, or Shabbat, to birth her into the world through the phallus of Yesod and Tiferet. And that is eight steps below. So the 8 days of the Milah symbolize the eight steps of the soul in its descent from Bina to Shechina. Here, the She, capital She in the Zohar, sometimes means Bina and sometimes means Shechina, right? The soul that is flown from her, from Bina, should appear before her, Shechina, on the eighth day, since she is the eighth rung. And that feminine energy, or the water, feminine energy is often conceived of as liquid in the mystical tradition. Even in the 13th century Spanish mystics, they talk about mayim nukvim, the feminine waters. They imagine a kind of fertile environment for things to transport or move themselves. And so the very feminine energy draws the soul down into this world, ultimately to give birth, and then a kind of 8-day birth below to symbolize the descent of that soul fully once the body is born. So first the body gets created, and then the soul does not get fully instantiated until the 8th day of its development, representing the descent from Bina to Shekhinah.
So it seems like we've gone from the physical, circumcision to the ethereal soul. So I missed the link. You know, we jumped, we started talking about circumcision, okay, 8th day, and now we're talking about souls that originate in Bina, coming to Shina, and standing before her. I'm missing a link here.
Yeah, so I think they're describing what happens in the 8 days leading up. In other words, that's like what's going to happen on the 8th day, but wait, what happened on the 1st day? So the body is born, but then the soul has to kind of descend into the body. And so just as the soul is slow to leave the body upon death, the soul is slow to enter the body, or gradual to enter the body. And in order to do so, the foreskin represents the sitra achra, or forces of evil. So at any turn, the soul could be captured by demonic forces, which seek to derail sanctity entering this world. And by the way, those demonic forces are represented by sexual temptation, largely. And classically, and in many places, the Zohar will describe the two acts of, I think we're going to get it ourselves in a minute, you know, we'll describe them as great sea monsters. The two evil people are always the male evil person and the female evil person. The Tiferet and the Shekhinah have their parallels of Sma'el and Lilith, right? So Lilith is the feminine demon and Sma'el is the masculine demon, and they parallel Tiferet and Shekhinah in trying to create evil in the world. They're the alter egos of the divine reality, the devils, as it were. And so this attempt at human procreation, says the Zohar, and imbuing it with sanctity, or this attempt at imbuing physicality in our actual lives with divine creativity and energy, you know, it could get caught up in our own self-gratification, or in our own ego or narcissism or human things. And so our acts of transcendence could become wholly self-indulgent, which is how we started, you remember. The Zohar said that yira, awe of God, could become fear of God, but fear of God is bad because it's focused on the self, the Zohar started by saying, whereas awe of God is fundamentally connected. And so another way of saying this, efforts at transcendence through physical things could easily become indulgent and non-transcendent, could get people stuck in themselves. And so the Zohar is really making broad comments now about avodah shebegashmiut, the perils of living the good life as a holy way of being things. And you could just become greedy, rich, powerful, spoiled, and corrupt, non-transcendent, stuck in the self. Because we always want to lessen self and merge with more in order to open up divine flow. And so one way to do that is sex. But another way to do just the opposite is sex. So far, right? It's to be, you could be using it immorally and corruptly and in non-connective ways and selfishly. And that is symbolized by the product of procreation, which itself has a sexual organ, which could be used for bad, symbolized by the foreskin, which they understand to be a kind of pleasure and enjoyment of physicality, or that could be peeled back and inscribed with divinity, right? And so we can, through our physical enjoyment of food, make a bracha and release the souls trapped in the food, the Zohar will say, and connect with everything. or we could eat food and be selfish. And as the Torah says, Ram Levavi, you know, you'll say, Kochem, Kochiva Otsim Yadia Salietach, I did this. You know, so food, you could eat food, you could be ascetic. The Zohar is asking us to take the Shvil HaZahav, ironically, the middle path, and say, no, don't be ascetic, be religiously materialistic. But be aware that just on the other side of religious materialism is being a spoiled brat. And that would be very bad. Being ascetic would be bad too. Not procreating as much as you could would also be bad. So when you do have a kid, you've got to do the circumcision in order to put this all in its place, you see. Does that answer the question, Rabbi Confer?
Yeah. So did I summarize it correctly to say the soul from Bina descends to Shechina, but the soul could be captured by the foreskin demonic forces like Lilith and Smael, and the soul, Nefesh Chaya, is inscribed with the Yud, the divine element, to kind of offset this waylaying. Is that, I know they didn't make it into, my mind tries to make this into a straight line, and they're going in waves.
Well, so it's more, the act of circumcision itself helps ensure, for the Zohar, why do we circumcise? To help ensure that the soul will be holy and not demonic, that human procreativity and religious efforts and physical efforts will lead to sanctity and not demons. So the making the letter of the Yud is the circumcision. The act of circumcision is like turning, is drawing the Yud. The Moel is like the Sofer, writing the Yud. And so it has theurgic cosmic power to do this circumcision. That's the only thing I would amend. Now, the Book of Enoch, we don't know exactly what they mean, but you should know that in the Heichalot tradition, which the Zohar mystics sometimes are kind of building on, three Enoch or Sefer HaHeichalot and different versions of it become very, very important. They concern the ascent of Hanukh and Eliyahu, right, the two people that ascend during their lives to become figures. So this is apparently referenced, you know, Matt says it's like an imagined Zoharic library, probably. I think, who am I? Daniel Matt's the expert. My sense is what they mean is a Heichalot tradition that they might have had orally, or they might be loosely referring to a kind of Heichalot teaching we may or may not have. There are many versions of, and even these traditions go way back to the Dead Sea Scrolls communities where we get versions of books of Enoch. You know, there are different manuscripts and some of them exist in current versions of the books of Enoch and some not. So there must have been many kind of Gnostic mystical traditions that had texts and teachings about this. And it's not hard to imagine the Spanish community of mystics being in possession of some of them or being told some of them. And the fact that there aren't in the few versions of these books we have now didn't really mean much, but they seem to think it's in some Enoch-related literature. So there it says it, and it uses the term Nefesh Chaya. Yeshua Samaim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya. The living being comes into the soul. It adds more souliness. In preference to all other marks of the world. Right, so this is the apex. That's a response to the Greek critique, Hanukkah is coming, that this represented a kind of mutilation of the human form, which is beautiful. And so here, the Zohar says, there's nothing so beautiful as, I'm always, what are they responding to? There's nothing so beautiful as human efforts. What, you know, it's not what's created, which is beautiful and perfect as is. It's human efforts at partnering in creation to create channels of holiness in a world that could easily be demonic that are beautiful. it's not about, I'm kind of fetishizing the natural world. So this is pro-human, as it were, anthropocentric in a certain way, but pro-anthropositive. All right.
Can I ask, so is one way to look at this, and this may be what you're saying, but Yishritsu Imani is sort of like pure potentiality, creation. Sheretz is the possibility of this like demonic kind of evolution, but then Nefesh Chaya is like a human intervention. Is that how we read this verse? Like almost like these are the stages of you know, pure potentiality, but it could go either way. But then Nefesh Chaya is human intervention, i.e. circumcision to...
Well, no, I think it's like this. Neshama is the kind of earthly level of soul, which you always have no matter what. And then doing the circumcision brings Nefesh Chaya, brings higher levels of soul down. That's how I think it is.
Okay.
Kind of moving up the Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama. You move from Nefesh to Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, which is the next level of soul, something transcendent. You go from Nefesh to Chaya.
Right. I guess what I'm trying to get is that connection from Yitrezu Hamayim, like that, to Nefesh Chaya. Are we intended to read like a flow there? Like Yishritsu Hamayim is like the most base level or some such
thing. Yeah, and I think the way the Kabbalist understands Yishritsu Hamayim, feminine waters ascend and bring down, action from below, the circumcision causes a wave to come up and draw down a soul. So they imagine that by doing this circumcision, they're creating the form of Yud, which is a way of calling up to Yud the highest levels, Yud being Chokhmah, present only in and through Binah. And so just to make it clear, they imagine that the Mohel is engaging in an almost shaman-like ceremony to channel down the soul from the upper realms and allow the soul to vest in the body. That's what's occurring at the circumcision ceremony, in which case it becomes much more than a technical cutting. It becomes this great ceremony, which of course sets the stage for Elijah. Right now we understand the grandeur of the ceremony, the soul. Now Elijah, when he ascends to heaven, you have to understand in the Hechalot literature, the whole point, probably the main thesis of the Hechalot literature, other than Rabbi Yishmael, the Kohen Gadol high priest's ascent, is Elijah's ascent. And when he ascends, he becomes no less than the angel Metatron, right? The highest angel in heaven, just below God. And we've come across the Sar HaPanim, as he's been called sometimes in the Zohar before, the Prince of the Faces. And you should know that there's an altar, Chanuch and Elijah sometimes merge into this emanated angel-like figure who is Metatron sometimes, but also sometimes Sandalphon. Metatron would be like the higher level angel, the Tiferet, as it were, and Sandalphon would be like the Shekhinah in the angelic realm, if that makes sense. So it's like an emanated angel figure. They're not necessarily distinct angels, but Chanuch and Eliyahu are like versions of each other. And Sandalphon, you should know, is important because we have the Sandak, right? You have two things that happen. You have the bris, you have the chair of Elijah, which is going to come about because of this teaching, which we're going to read. And you also have the Sandak. Sandak means Kisei Shel Sandalphon. It's an acronym. That's what the Sandak is. So it's the chair of Sandalphon. So the idea is Elijah's chair is kind of like Metatron, the highest angel, and the Sandak sits in the chair next to it, kind of a lower manifestation of that same angel energy, but actually in a person who is honored to be the Sandak, and the soul kind of flows through that person from the Mohel into the person. So in this, it's not just that the bris takes on significance, but the ritual items at the bris take on cosmic, they're like representative objects. And Elijah's chair becomes a way of channeling particular divine energy. And the Sandak, the person who holds the child down during the bris, becomes an angel, an actual human angel for their role. It's like a play, and people are being assigned parts. So let's read about this. and we'll continue this next time. We'll call it First Mila, the mystical play. So we'll just read it. Let the birds fly above the earth. So once you do this below, what are the birds flying above the earth? This is Elijah who sweeps the entire world in four glides. It's a Talmudic teaching about how different angels come in different amounts of stops. To be present at that holy circumcision, one must prepare a chair for him and declare this is the chair of Elijah. If not, he does not abide there. So Elijah is responsible for assigning human souls into their bodies in the Hechalot, earlier mystical literature. And so in order to get this to go, you need Elijah to cooperate. Now, there is a whole tradition about Elijah in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which the Zohar is assuming. So we're going to open up next time with that mystical tradition. Why exactly does Elijah have a special role in the soul and the Brit Milah circumcision ceremony? So that's what we'll open with next time. We're going to read the original Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. We'll read that mystical account of Elijah and Queen Jezebel and what happens there. So I know we're ending in the middle and moving somewhat deliberately, but I think the material is rich enough that if you fly through it, you just miss all the good stuff. So hopefully you agree. So next week, there's a small chance I might not be able to make next week, in which case we'll do the week after. I'll let you know as soon as I can, but I'm going to try and make next week if we can.
Thank
Final
you.
Comments or questions, anyone?
Thank you.
All right, thank you all.
I just had a thought about the Freudian equation of the pen and penis. So the idea of inscription connected to the circumcision actually has more contemporary resonance as well.
Okay, that's really interesting. Okay, let's think about that.